So, say your name and what you do.
Ken Caldera. I'm a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science on the Stanford campus.
Okay, what I want to talk to you about, Ken, is because you've been in this game an awfully long time, you have...
Oh man, you're making me feel old.
I've been doing it for 25 years myself.
Okay.
I want to get your view on how things have changed over that period of time in terms of our understanding of the science.
I believe most of the basic climate science was fairly well understood by 1980 or so. And most of what's happened since then is increasing confidence in those results and filling in details. There's been a shift from exploration of basic physical science towards more what do we do about the climate problem, and a shift more to looking at energy system transitions and a little bit less on basic climate science than there used to be.
You still have a situation in the USA, though, where you couldn't get elected as a Republican candidate without casting doubt on the veracity of climate science. So there's still some way to go, isn't there? I mean, and some people just think you've had the pause in warming, which was not well expected and not well explained at the time. You know, a lot of people just simply don't trust the science.
Many US politicians don't believe in biological evolution or many other well-established facts, and this is more an issue with the nature of our political discourse and has relatively little to do with the scientific process. So the science of climate change is well-established and has been well-established for many decades.
So we're in, an interesting time at the moment with technologies coming through apace, with governments acting in greater concert than they have before, with cities acting. Do you sense a change? You've been in it a long time.
I think things are starting to change in that there's increasing consensus towards action. We see this with the Pope's recent encyclical. Now the idea that we have to do something about climate change has become the mainstream position, and the people who think we don't have to worry about the future of the Earth is becoming increasingly a minority position. That said, there's a tendency for politicians to try to do little feel-good activities that play well to the public but don't really make a substantial difference in climate change. To really solve the climate problem, we need to revolutionize our whole system of energy production and consumption. We basically have to stop building things with smokestacks and tailpipes, and this is a tall order.
It's a very tall order, and it's also an expensive order.
Yes, and not only is it expensive for us, but it's expensive for the poorest of the world who are just developing their economies. If, say, sub-Saharan Africa develops their energy system around coal and natural gas, there's the danger of lock-in and a future of high CO2 emissions. It's very difficult to get the developed countries to pay the cost differential for a clean energy system for the poorest of the world, and it's also difficult to ask them to bear this burden.
Well, the coal industry now, the global coal industry, is now saying there's a moral case for people to use coal, because coal was the fuel which dragged us out of poverty, which fueled development around the world, and it's immoral to deny it to developing countries.
There's no shortage of immorality. Maybe it was immoral for us to use coal as well.
Although we didn't know at the time.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to tell the poorest of the world that you can't use the technology that we use to develop. And I do believe there's an ethical burden on the part of the richer countries to help pay the cost differential between the dirty old energy systems and the clean new energy systems that we need to be building. But that's a tough political sell, certainly in the United States, and I bet in Europe as well.
You're in an unusual position, having studied the physical sciences and also looked at technologies. What position do you think we're in now on technology?
I think the main barrier to deep reduction in emissions right now is not so much technological as establishing a broad political consensus among the populace. The average person needs to be willing to spend some money to protect the future of the climate system, and the average American is not quite there yet. With regard to technologies, I believe the technologies to get to something like 80% reduction in emissions exist, that better technologies could make that cheaper, and eventually we're going to need to cut deeper than that, and so there's certainly a room for research and development, but there's plenty that we can start deploying today.
Where do you think the technological advancements will come in the future?
the key advances needed in technology really have to do with transmission and storage. If we think of wind and solar power as major energy sources for the future, they're intermittent sources, they're not reliable. People need electricity when they need it. And unless we have nearly global scale intercontinental superconducting electricity grids or some kind of amazing battery technology that doesn't now exist that allows energy to be stored for weeks at utility scale, it's very difficult to get beyond this, say, 80% reduction. If the economy is going to be something like five times bigger by the end of this century globally, and we just get an 80% reduction in emissions per unit GDP, by the end of the century we'll be back where we are today unless we really develop new energy technologies. So there's plenty we can do today, but the long term requires new technology development.
Almost all the scenarios from the IPCC project an overshoot, so we'll overshoot the 2 Celsius mark, and then using carbon capture and storage by burning biomass to claw CO2 back out of the atmosphere. You've been involved with carbon capture and with similar technologies. What are you thinking about that?
I'm quite skeptical that society is really going to deploy massive systems to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. I think we need to focus on reducing our emissions. Power plant flue gases are typically 10% or more CO2. The atmosphere is 0.04% CO2. It's much easier to get the CO2 out of a 10% gas.
And it's much cheaper as well.
And much cheaper. And basically, to pull the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we'd need to build another system at the same scale as our energy system. And it's just easier to build a good energy system than to pollute now and try to clean it up later.
What about using bioenergy with carbon capture and storage? So the plants grow, they take up the CO2 out of the atmosphere, you burn the plants, you capture the CO2, you bury it underground.
I think the idea of biomass energy with carbon capture and storage overall is good, although I'm skeptical that biomass energy can really be scaled up adequately. Trees and plants take a lot of land to grow. Typically, you get something like 1 watt per square meter out of bioenergy crops. And the amount of land that would be required is simply enormous. I think solar power and perhaps nuclear power are probably the main energy sources for the second half of this century.
And if we mess up, which it looks as though we will, what about geoengineering? You've been involved in that too. Geoengineering, so, you know, keeping the sun off the land, seeding the oceans.
Climate models suggest that if we reflected a few percent of the incoming sunlight, that society could cool the earth, and this would offset most of the direct climate effects of increased greenhouse gases. Of course, this is a very risky approach, and as time goes on and the greenhouse gases accumulate and the amount of aerosols in the stratosphere increase, it's likely that something ugly would happen. And so, to my mind, these geoengineering options are something we might want to keep in reserve in a sort of break glass in case of emergency setting. I think the more likely outcome is that we more or less muddle through and try to adapt as best we can to what climate change does occur.
Does that leave you optimistic?
I'm optimistic that we'll start doing something. I'm not quite optimistic that we'll do enough to really avoid large amounts of climate change. We've done a study that's now in review that looks at what happens if we burn through the fossil fuels and don't leave it in the ground. And we find that eventually all of Antarctica would melt, which would bring something like 60 meters of sea level rise. That's something like 200 feet for the Americans. And at a rate, not this century, but in future centuries, of maybe 2 or 3 centimeters each year. And this rate of sea level rise, I think, is something that will be challenging to deal with and is something that is likely in our future unless we revolutionize our energy system quite soon.
So that's a pretty dismal outlook then.
I guess the positive side is I think that humans are quite adaptable in the sense that we already live from the equator to the Arctic Circle. And I also study effects of climate change and ocean acidification on coral reefs. And I think these kinds of sensitive ecosystems are likely doomed if we continue current emission patterns. But people are relatively adaptable and resilient. And so I think we might find humans doing reasonably okay.
10 billion of us doing reasonably okay?
Well,
might need to kill off a few billion, perhaps?
I think this is a good point. I think the rich could be fairly protected from climate change, or might be. But if we think of ecosystems as the poorest of the poor, the non-cash world, are in big trouble. And I think the poorest of the people are in big trouble. Obviously, if you live in the Sahel or you live on a low-lying island nation, that your prospects for adaptation are meager. On the other hand, if you're a wealthy person in North America or in Europe, I think there's a likelihood that you'll be able to get by.
And that's so, quite a seductive message, though, to North Americans. You know, install a few LEDs, otherwise carry on regardless. You'll be okay.
I think this is the danger, that I think there's a feeling that if I'm driving a Prius, I'm doing something good, or if I'm using an LED light, I'm doing something good, where I'm really just polluting slightly slower than I would have been otherwise. And I think this is the danger, that we'll do these small feel-good measures to feel like we're doing something about climate change, but meanwhile the planet keeps getting hotter and hotter. But I don't think it's the role of the scientist to say, oh, it's all doom and gloom and we're facing extinction, if that's not what the science says. I think reality is bad enough. And I think really maybe we need to start turning things around and talk about, well, it's possible to have a world where people are happy, healthy, and prosperous, and where we produce energy in a way that's consistent with our long-term survival on this planet. You know, right now in the U.S., we're paying something like 10% of our GDP for our military and 20% for healthcare, and economists think that it would cost a few percent of GDP to transform our energy system into one that doesn't use the sky as a waste dump. And the scale of the climate challenge is the scale of things that societies have dealt with successfully in the past, and it's just a matter of organizing ourselves and deciding to actually do it.
With massive vested interest, though, pushing in the other direction.
Yes, we're not going to solve this problem until the average person thinks it's important to solve. At least in the United States, we can't expect leaders to lead. We can expect political leaders to try to get reelected. And until they feel that not voting in favor of doing something substantive about climate change is going to lose them the election, they're going to respond to the vested interest. And so really, it's about getting the average person to understand that this is an important problem that needs to be solved, and getting them to vote the way they believe, which is why I think it can't all be doom and gloom. I think we need to be presenting a more of a positive vision about, you know, how we can build an energy system based on good clean energy technologies and can provide people with energy needed for development and a good economy, and that people can live in a better world that's not threatened by climate change.
But I saw a study recently suggesting that a large percentage of American school leavers, from memory it was around 50%, weren't actually convinced that humans were involved in climate change at all. And that's hardly surprising, given that's what they hear from a lot of their political leaders.
Democracy depends on...
I'm wondering where your optimism comes from.
Well, democracy depends on having a well-informed populace, and unfortunately we don't have a well-informed populace today.
And you're not going to get one.
Well, I think we can distinguish between what's possible and what's an expectation. And if you say, what's my central expectation? My central expectation is that we'll do a little bit around the margins, that the Earth will get a lot hotter, the ice caps will melt, and we'll just kind of muddle through and deal with it, and the poorest of the poor will suffer disproportionately. But it doesn't need to be that way. If we could just get a political consensus to act on this issue, it would cost a few percent of GDP, and we could solve this problem and get going now with existing technology and finish off the job with newly developed technology. But it takes a democratic process that is going to respond to problems that are global in scope and multi-decadal or even multi-century in timescale. And our political system's designed around responding to the news cycle, and this is not a problem that lends itself to the news cycle. So it's an extraordinary challenge. I'm not confident we'll meet the challenge, but it's possible that we could meet the challenge.
Ken Caldera, thank you.
Thank you.